I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Dr. Katie Perez-Lacy. She is a child and adolescent psychiatrist, and James Besante, who is a student at the University of New Mexico. He's president and founder of Students for a National Health Program. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thanks for having me.
So, James, let's start with you. We were talking a little while ago to Senator Ortiz Pino about the idea of health care as a human right. Talk more about that. How do you conceive of the difference between health care as a commodity that works according to market principles and health care as a basic, publicly supported human right like education?
Well, that's a very good question. I think the reason we went about framing this discussion in terms of a human right is because when you use human rights framing, you're able to embed the principles of universality, equity, and accountability into healthcare reform. And that's what we're hoping to steer future reform with. And this is what we've seen with public education. We led with a right to public education, and in many cases, that was through constitutional amendments on a state-by-state basis.
Just like this.
Court rulings and legal precedents steered reform efforts towards equitable solutions that empowered every student to access that education, which he was given a right to.
So back in the day, I don't know when that was, but I mean, were there people saying, I don't see why everybody should have an education? I mean, what was the debate like? Do you know?
I'm not as versed in that actual debate, but with every social movement, every rights movement, there's always, you know, substantial opposition. Civil rights is no exception. There was a time not very long ago when we did not see a right of all people to live the American dream in our country and not base that on things outside their character. There's always going to be substantial opposition, and eventually those will be overcome.
Dr. Perez-Lacy, you are a psychiatrist. You have seen a lot of changes in the healthcare system. You've got patients, you work with children, adolescents, you've got patients who can pay, you've got patients perhaps increasingly who can't. What does that look like from the point of view of your position as doctor?
Well, I've seen over the years that patients have had increasing difficulty getting the services that they need to have. We've had to jump over more and more hoops for them to be able to get services, to be able to get more sessions, or be able to be hospitalized, for children to be able to enter a residential treatment center if they're very ill, to be able to get the medicines or the dosage that they need for medicines. And it's become very frustrating. I've had to advocate for them a lot. And so it's been very sad to see how my patients can't get their services. And it's been sad because this is care that they need. And they're being turned away when they're supposed to have insurance. Now, apart from that, in these economic times, I've had a couple of patients who've lost their insurance, and I've continued to see them because I do believe that they have a right to health care. And sometime in the future, I hope that they will get a job, but, you know, I believe that they need to be seen, and I continue to see them.
So basically, because there's not universal insurance that covers people when they lose their jobs or when their parents lose their jobs, whatever, you suffer a financial loss. And you can't do that, obviously, for everybody, but you are willing to absorb that?
Of course, yes. And I can't do it with all my patients, but I can do it for a few. Now, I also have a patient who does have insurance, but her employer is having a difficult time, so he had to decrease her pay. Now, she has insurance, but with that decrease in pay, she cannot pay her co-pays for her medications, so she's now taking her medications every other day. Well, she has hypertension and she has diabetes. So, you know, those are medications that you can't take every other day. But because she has insurance, she doesn't qualify for getting the kind of medication services that indigent people can get. So she stuck, and she is an insured person. So this is obviously not fair, especially in the United States of America. It's very frustrating.
Do your colleagues, your doctor colleagues, tend to do what you do, which is see patients who can't pay?
I don't really know, but I do know that all my colleagues are equally frustrated as I am with the current conditions of medical care.
Dr. Perez-Lacy, I want to ask you, why is it, what is it about society and stepping outside just the problems of the healthcare system, which are vast, that there are so many young people who need mental health care in the first place? What's going on?
Well, I think it's a very complex problem, and I think you'd probably need, someone who's really dedicated themselves to studying that problem because it is so complex. But I can tell you one thing is that a lot of the serious illnesses that youngsters have most of the time are inherited, things like bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, and severe anxiety disorders. Some other disorders like post-traumatic stress disorder will occur due to traumatic experiences that youngsters can suffer if they've grown up in traumatic environments, which often occur in situations of poverty or severe domestic violence. The other big thing in our environment today is the access to drugs, and that, of course, we're seeing exists through all social levels of society. And, of course, domestic violence is present in all levels of society. So I think also the violence that we see in schools is present in all our schools, all our public schools. So youngsters today are subjected to a lot of stress, a lot more stress than certainly I experienced when I was a youngster.
James Besante, let's go back to the international perspective. We talked about this a little bit with Senator Ortiz-Pino, but how are other countries succeeding in this whole question of providing health care, health insurance to their citizens?
That's a great perspective to look at this debate on healthcare as a human right. And it's important to recognize that the U.S. has actually been a primary signatory in several international covenants and treaties where it's explicitly stated the right to health care. One of them is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It's a 60-year anniversary 2 years ago. And that stated explicitly that everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and his family. Now, these are documents, international treaties, that the U.S. signed onto. And when they were signed, there was an expectation that the countries who were signatories would go and implement these ideas into domestic law. And, following the 60th anniversary, there was a UN report put out going over where this has evolved, this right to health care, this right to housing and education. And many of the countries who originally signed on have fallen short. The U.S. is no exception. Currently, the U.S. has some of the lowest indicators and health outcomes when compared to other post-industrialized nations. So from an international perspective, the U.S. has already established the right to the human right to health care. We're trying to recognize it here in New Mexico. In other countries where this right is being vindicated to their population, you see better outcomes. You see a healthier population. And sadly, the case is that people on average live shorter, less healthy lives here in the U.S. And that may be because their right to health care is not being vindicated by the state.
Now, who are the uninsured?
The uninsured make up a huge portion of our population. You've said previously on your program that it's almost a quarter of New Mexico's population is uninsured. And part of that is also the underinsured, who can actually afford to get sick. There was a very interesting study, a Harvard study put out that was also part of the Kaiser Foundation research group that said, a vast majority of cancer patients suffer severely from financial distress, whether that's collection calls from different collection agencies or their foregoing care.
Wait a minute. You've got cancer patients being called by collection agencies to pay their medical bills?
Definitely. Almost one quarter, or actually greater than a quarter of cancer patients in this survey, which was over 2,000 cancer patients were surveyed, reported calls from collection agencies. And in fact, I believe Obama has a very compelling story of when he was younger and he heard his mother arguing with collection agencies and insurance companies over her own cancer treatment. So this is...
And she died of cancer.
She did, in fact, die of cancer. So this, like Dr. Lacey said, this goes through all facets of our society. And there really is a moral imperative to vindicate this right, which we've already signed on to internationally.
Dr. Perez-Lacey, we talked a moment ago about the difference between the idea of the patient as a commodity or the healthcare system as a market system versus the healthcare system as a basic human right. And I think it goes even beyond basic human rights. It goes as a basic human relationship, the doctor-patient relationship, which should not, I think, be impeded by questions of ability to afford being able to enter into that relationship.
Right. You know, Mary Charlotte, when I went into medicine, they trained us. Part of our training was in rapport, that you needed to develop a relationship with your patient, that was very important. And they also taught us, the first rule that they taught us was in Latin, was primum non nocere, first do no harm, that it was a sacred relationship, a bond, a responsibility that you carried in regard to this person standing before you. And so that, to me, was very important. Every individual that you met became a very important relationship. And you have... You know, to me, it's a responsibility that I carry and that I advocate for that person, and that I need to take care of them, and I need to make sure that if they are ill, I have to help them get better to the best of my ability. And that means if they need to see a different doctor, if I don't know how to help them, I need to refer them to someone who does. And if they need a certain medicine, I need to help them get it. And the insurance companies throw obstacles, so I need to go through all the obstacles. I'm their advocate. So over the years, I've had to jump through more and more hoops in order to do my job.
And it does that look like? Like, what does your day look like? Do you spend a lot of time on the phone, for example, with insurance companies that you could be spending with patients?
Exactly.
Really?
Yes. And there are doctor's offices who have had to hire a whole other person who spends their day, that's 5 days a week, who does nothing but talk to insurance companies. Absolutely nothing, but they arrive at 8 in the morning and they start talking to insurance companies. They're not doing billing. They're not doing anything else but talking to insurance companies 8 to 5 every day because of these obstacles. And so,
now, if you do the math on that, I don't know what the salary of that
right.
kind of employee is.
Exactly.
But let's say with their own insurance, it's
right.
$50,000 a year per doctor's office.
Mm-hmm.
And you multiply that by every doctor's office that has one of those,
mm-hmm.
and then you add that to
right.
the cost of healthcare in the United
right.
States. That's millions,
right.
if not billions.
And imagine that it's a hospital.
There was actually a really interesting study that was done between a hospital in the U.S. and a hospital in Canada, comparable hospitals with similar services.
Right.
And they looked at the employees at each hospital. And they found that in the U.S., there was an extra 175 employees who they couldn't account for, or a number close to that. And when they evaluated their job descriptions further, they found that they were for billing and other administrative processes. Now, this hospital in Canada had three employees who performed similar functions. And their jobs were actually to bill Americans who got sick in Canada. So this
oh
is
my goodness.
Also affecting, you know, hospitals in Canada, that they're having to employ extra personnel to bill Americans who are fall sick in their country.
Wow.
Yeah. So anyhow, what's happened to me is I've felt like I've had to, you know, become a warrior on behalf of my patients in order for them to get their services. And I've also had to find ways for me to get paid, but I know that I don't get paid for all the extra time I spend on their behalf, but I consider it just part of my job, because I do take my relationship to them as for granted that this is what I will do for them, because healthcare is a human right, and that is what they deserve.
James Bisante, let's go back to the amendment process. How does amending the New Mexico Constitution work?
There's three ways to amend the New Mexico Constitution. For this amendment to recognize the human right to healthcare, we're using the joint resolution route, which requires a simple majority in the House and the Senate of this joint resolution. If it were to do with voting rights or education, we would need a superior majority, but this does not, so we need a simple majority, and this will put it on ballot before voters, because ultimately it's up to New Mexicans to amend their constitution. It will bypass the governor. There is no gubernatorial route or gubernatorial role in this amendment process. So it's ultimately going to be left up to voters, and that's really what we're stressing here is, to the legislature, give the people of New Mexico the chance to vote on this amendment.
So if this is passed, it can't be vetoed by the governor. It goes straight to the voters. Have voters in other states been doing this? Is this something that there are campaigns all over the country to do similar things?
Well, yeah. The amendments to make healthcare a human right began after some work of the late Archbishop of Chicago, Cardinal Joseph Bernardin, and his work with health as a human right. And he worked extensively on this before he passed away from his own battle with pancreatic cancer.
Right.
Following his writings, some of his pastoral letters were incredibly compelling and inspired an entire generation, and that's part of his legacy. Many states went about a process to amend their state constitution to recognize the human right to health care. However, no state has been successful in that. And one of the key tools the opposition to this idea that health care is a human right have used is to keep it from voters. Many, many attempts in other states, whether that's North Carolina, Oregon, or Minnesota, have let this amendment die in committees. And no amendment to make health care a human right has actually gone before an electorate to decide on a ballot. So if we can, you know, secure the simple majority in the New Mexico State and House and get this to ballot, that would be the first time that voters in a state have had the opportunity to vote on an amendment to their constitution to recognize healthcare as a human right.
And it would be hard to imagine voters in a state saying, no, we don't believe that we have this right.
Exactly. Especially in a state like New Mexico, which has almost a quarter of our population uninsured. So over 80,000 children uninsured. That's larger than the population of Las Cruces of uninsured children in our state.
If this were all to happen and there were an amendment to the New Mexico Constitution guaranteeing health care or stating that health care is a human right, things, certainly we know in the history of constitutional law in the United States, things are always being interpreted and reinterpreted. What would happen? I mean, not that you can predict the future, but what's your sense of it?
Well, constitutional amendments are actually quite beautiful in that they are a dynamic definition. For example, our right to free speech has developed over 200 years, and what we consider free speech today isn't what we considered free speech over 200 years ago. And that's changed as societies develop, as our outlooks on things like free speech or healthcare or education evolve and change, so do amendments. And that's through court rulings and legal precedents. And so what we consider health and well-being today and the necessary resources to ensure that health and well-being may be different in 100 years from now, and actually they most certainly will be. With this amendment, the idea that healthcare is a human right can evolve with our own changing idea of what health is.
There is always the question, and you know that if this becomes an issue that's on the ballot, this constitutional amendment, there will be big battles and big media battles about whether New Mexico can afford this.
Definitely. That's a primary concern. And when you're looking at a budget crisis, when you're looking at an economic recession, that's a huge question, is can we afford this? Many people have equated it to an unfunded mandate. But important to bring to that idea is that education is an unfunded mandate. And we do have a right to public education in the state. And that's actually in Article 12, Section 1 of our Constitution. And interestingly, the Judiciary Committee of the state legislature put out a fiscal report on this amendment and what the fiscal implications would be for the state. And they drew a very, you know, interesting comparison between public education, that yes, we have a right to public education in the state. Does that mean every New Mexican student has a brand new laptop and a private tutor? No, it does not. There are very real constraints on every public good, and honest people can agree on those constraints. Does that mean we shouldn't make a right to healthcare in our state? No, that's not grounds to dismiss the idea that healthcare is a human right. And in fact, if we look at historical experiences, there's no better time to rally around a fundamental right like this than in, you know, economic recession, in times of war. In Britain, they established their national healthcare system while London was being bombed. I mean, this is something that unified the country. When you're in your darkest hour, that's when you really establish who we are as a society. And this amendment would be a ruler to gauge where we are and to evaluate future reform. And I'd also like to point out that this amendment doesn't mandate the state spend any particular amount of money. There is no real fiscal implications, only that the state begin a process considered progressive realization, wherein which this amendment and this right will be vindicated in the future. And there's compelling evidence and research to show that you can insure every New Mexican and, in fact, reduce the cost to the state.
And we've talked about that at some length on this program earlier when we were talking about the Health Security Act and different ways of doing the exchanges and so on. Who in New Mexico, in terms of groups and so on, is supporting this constitutional amendment?
Well, there's a broad range of support for this amendment. Some of our key endorsements have come from Health Action New Mexico, that has worked on various campaigns to realize health equity in the state, the League of Women Voters in New Mexico, the Native Health Initiative, a network of health professionals for National Health Program, New Mexico Council of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, the Ministerial Alliances. There's a broad range of people interested in social justice, interested in realizing healthcare as a fundamental right in our state. And we're working together, we're working diligently to tell the legislators in the legislative session, please give New Mexicans the opportunity to vote on this. Today, tomorrow, if every representative and every senator agreed with this amendment, our Constitution would not be amended, because ultimately it is the voters' decision.
Right. Now, you are a student at the University of New Mexico. You are hoping to go to med school. You are majoring in both sociology and chemistry, and your work as an undergraduate is looking at how those things come together here in the state of New Mexico. Tell us a little bit about what your studies have shown.
Definitely. Some of my research has been social determinants of illnesses caused from pollution. I've looked in New Mexico, and I've also looked internationally. One work that I'm actually in the process of having published is on the social determinants of cadmium-caused diseases. So these are heavy metals that are runoff from mining operations, mostly in East Asia, and they contaminate water sources that, you know, supply agrarian communities. And we've seen just absolutely horrendous outcomes in these populations from mining up river, whether that's zinc ore mining or the different mining operations, and the effect they've had on populations that truly have no place in politics in this country. They've been politically disenfranchised, And from that, they're unable to appropriately control these mining operations pollution.
James, you are president of Students for National Health Program. What kind of awareness and attitudes do you see among ordinary UNM students when you talk about these issues?
Well, this is an issue that's, you know, particularly close to home with many students. You know, recently I reached a certain age where I was booted off my parents' health insurance. Part of the recent federal reform will help a lot of students being kicked off their parents' health insurance, as long as you don't claim independent. So there are other loopholes where students will still not be covered. If they're independent from their parents, they won't have access to that insurance once they reach a certain age. In some cases, that's 21, 22, 23. Students, you know, are, for the most part, a healthier population. Many of us feel we don't need health insurance. And there's this kind of, you know, misconception that this isn't an issue that affects us. You know, many go without health insurance. I've done it myself. While you're a student, you have so many expenses and your budget is so fixed that it's very hard to, you know, pull from that budget and put that money into an insurance program. Now, as far as reform, students are a very active group. I speak with students frequently at UNM and other campuses. I do tabling, and I try and raise awareness of, you know, health inequities in our state, in our country, and different reform processes that we could implement, not only at a state level, but a federal level. And students are perceptive to this. They're an active bunch of individuals. Many of them are beginning professional careers or looking at professional careers that may be connected to health, to medicine, or perhaps advocacy.
James Besante is president and founder of Students for a National Health Program. He's a student at the University of New Mexico. Katie Perez-Lacy is a child and adolescent psychiatrist. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thanks for having me.